Man, I like zombie takeout. You like zombie takeout?
Well, I've never really heard zombie takeout before.
You've never heard zombie takeout before?
My dad listens to Trailer Clash.
Ah, the king of podcasts.
What's up? Welcome to episode 210 of Zombie Taken,
Zombie Takeout.
The B Moving Cult Movie Podcast. I'm Uncle John.
And I'm Scotto.
And without any further ado, let's just get straight to this week's movie, which is from 1986, Blue Velvet. And of course, the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by the Slow Club. If you like mediocre beer and bad singing, then you'll love the Slow Club, now featuring magically disappearing musicians.
And also brought to you by Shameless Product Placement. Because when I drink a beer, it's gotta be Shameless Product Placement. Okay, this one, we went from the thin, wafferest thin pod plot to, holy shit. All right. A young man, I did not realize he was in college until I read something after it. I thought it was high school, but it was the 1950s, so who knows?
Just to reference my title suggestion from last week, this really is Muad'Dib and the screenplay of Convolutions.
He finds an ear in the grass, and he does the right thing. He puts the ear in a bag and takes it to the police straight away. The police, sits down and has a talk with the police officer. They take it to the morgue to see the coroner to see if anybody has come in missing an ear. Anybody missing an ear? What's going on? Nothing. It's, of course, a mystery. And that is what we're confronted with for this, a good portion of this film, even though it's pretty obvious what's happening. Although, how it's happening, I'm not really sure.
It's a David Lynch movie.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. This is, he goes out of his way to tell us that this is a typical 1950s town with, where everything seems perfect on the surface, but there's a dark side to it. And I think that's the part that I don't get.
Was it set in the 50s? Because there are a lot of things in the movie that do make sense with that, but then there are other more modern aspects that don't quite work with it.
You know, you're right. I hadn't even thought of that. I just assumed that that was a 1950s town because of the way it was all set up in the beginning. Yeah, wait a minute. The styles were all 1950s.
Many of them were. It was very 50s influenced, but then there were some more modern styles in there, too.
Well, right. There were these weird anachronisms in there where they're just, I mean, but it was supposed to be the 1950s, or
okay.
Else women would not have been dressed the way they were in school.
Fair enough.
The sweaters and all that stuff. That was all supposed to be 1950s, but yeah, I could see your confusion because there was a synth-heavy ballad towards the end of the film that just made no sense. But anyway, we're way off the path here.
Yeah.
We've gone off the rails somehow.
Fittingly.
Describing this David Lynch plot. So he gets wrapped up in this whole mystery. He brings in the detective's daughter in it, who feeds him some information and tries to be his lookout for him. It's a pretty jumbled mess. And honestly, the weird thing is, it is kind of structured, the plot, in sort of these episodes.
Yeah.
Like, they start with the intro, the ear. You get a little background of his family. Then you get the next chunk, which is he's flirting with her and he's casing
the police
joint.
Chief's daughter. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he crosses the threshold and breaks in to the lounge singer's house that is somehow, I'm not even sure how he was led to her, really.
The police chief's daughter had overheard some details on the case and had given him some information that connected her arrival in the lounge singer's arrival in town with the ear missing somehow. I don't remember the details.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said, this before we start recording, the sound on my copy was pretty shitty, so maybe I missed that. It was before I switched to subtitles. But yeah, and but if you didn't catch it either, I'm not sure exactly how he was led to her, but
I caught it, I just don't remember it.
he makes the break in, and then it goes to shit where he gets caught. And that
Then it
begins
gets
the next
real
chunk,
interesting.
which is I call a rape off. And then after that, of course, he gets kidnapped, which is the next chunk, and he really just goes to Oz after that, where he's seeing things. I mean, because he's supposed to be the ultimate innocent, you know? He is young Kyle MacLachlan, small town 50s Americana, apple pie, whatever cliche Lynch could throw at us. And then he's face to face with the devil. Now, I guess you could argue who the devil is, whether it is Dean Stockwell or Dennis Hopper. I don't know.
Well, one of them dies sooner than the other, so I would imagine it was. No, Stockwell's character doesn't die.
No. No,
That is a
he's
good
just in
question.
for his one appearance and then out. And of course, it's a very fucked up appearance that it is. And then, of course, he gets back to this whole mystery thing, which by then, really, there is no mystery after he's in Oz. You know everything that's going on, you know how fucked up these people are, how they've hidden in this town that's supposed to be so innocent. Is beyond me, although I guess they hid because of the person that they knew hiding them.
I suspect that was Lynch's point. Even Pleasantville has, its underside.
Well, yeah, that's the entire point of the movie, really. I mean, this is, the dark side and the upside, the top where you see the grass, and then the bottom where you see the bugs. And then the Robin, of course, at the end with the book. Really,
Never connected that until just now.
hilarity
Ensues.
ensues.
Now, you mentioned that the innocent town. I guess gotta mention the name of the town.
Oh, was it Lumberton?
Lumberton.
Yeah.
Really? But he does hit you over the head with the noir thing at first, because the opening music is very reminiscent of Hitchcock.
Well, I mean, there's nothing subtle about this. This is an absolute mallet of storytelling. We get it. Blue Velvet. I mean, it's waved in our faces.
And there was something toward the beginning of the film that kind of bugged me that makes sense now. A lot of the dialogue was very stilted and the acting was kind of iffy. And from some people who are definitely better than their performances.
Oh, yeah.
But then you get to the underside and it picks up and the acting gets better. And it gets much more naturalistic. And I think that was an attempt to show how sort of excessively innocent the town was.
Right. You get this whole, and I almost said Back to the Future, but this is kind of, well, I guess it's about the same time as Back to the Future.
It is indeed set in the 50s, yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say it came a year after, but this script apparently had been floating around
Oh,
Hollywood
yeah, for quite
for a
some time.
good 15 years. So who knows?
And I gotta admit, at least it doesn't waste any time getting to the plot.
Yeah, for a 2-hour movie, it is very tightly wound. Like those chunks of story, how I broke that down. That is really how the film works.
Within the first half hour, he's starting to get into Oz.
Well, yeah, 15 minutes, then another 15, and yeah, they're casing the joint after the first 15 minutes, So they're easing us in, but not making it painful.
Although the way he found the ear on paper works, but in execution it was very forced. He's cutting through a plot of land that has this little shack on it. in this bottle and this backstop, it's a stone throwing target. And he's picking up stones to throw at it. And then on his way back, he stops there again, picks up some stones, and finds the ear. On paper, that works. That makes a lot of sense. That's a very smooth way of having him find it. In the movie, it seemed really obvious and a very heavy plot point.
Oh, look, an ear.
Yeah. The way he bent over and was obviously looking for just the right stone and found the ear. It just was, I was just waiting for it to happen, in a sense, when it should have been much more natural, much more of a logical progression. However, I did like that Sandy was kind of the voice of reason, the police chief's daughter.
Yeah.
Whenever his plans got really insane, she was basically the voice of the audience saying, "You're really going to do that?"
That was refreshing because you have the whole Gatorade thing where it's just like, what's crazy about that?
Right.
Where everybody just agrees with the protagonist about going off on the quest. Yes, you have one person saying like, why would we do this?
Almost fell out of my chair laughing when she said that about breaking into the lounge singer's house. Although I did think it was odd that she was drinking at the slow club because she's a high school student, high school senior, well, presumably a senior.
That's what I thought too. I thought these were high school students,
Well, she is a high school student.
and someone online said they were. Oh, she was a high school student. He was a college student. I did not. Okay.
They went to the high school at the same time. They knew each other. So he's, at least a couple of years older.
Okay, now it makes sense.
I didn't realize it was set in the 50s. So I looked up when the drinking age was changed. It was changed in 84. It
Yeah.
was raised from 18 to 21.
Yeah, my sister's generation had it so much better.
So, as long as it's before 84, that works that she's drinking in the club. But it just struck me as odd.
It wasn't viewed as that much of a big deal until like the 80s. A lot of stuff with alcohol was not viewed as big a deal. I mean, they would give it to us as kids, in the 70s.
Yeah, same here. And
There
in
was
the 80s,
nothing.
for me.
Yeah,
At
there was
least
really,
family, at
well,
family.
right. There was really nothing looked on about it. Then it all went to shit.
And speaking of it all went to shit, well, I wouldn't say it went to shit, but just got real weird. The scene in the slow club.
I remember like the scenes of Twin Peaks and stuff. He just loves people going into a club and everybody OD'd on Prozac or something in the
See, I only watched a couple of episodes of Twin Peaks and never really got into it.
Me neither. But that's what I remember when I see. They were in some biker bar in Twin Peaks and they were just slow dancing to that Twin Peaks theme song, which of course, I mean, he's just doing to be weird. I mean, that was the thought I had at the time. I'm watching, he's just doing this to be weird.
And okay, starts with her drinking, which seemed odd, but okay. Makes sense if you look at it in the right time frame. And then we have probably the most egregious product placement we have ever witnessed on this show. That intro we did. Change every occurrence of zombie takeout to Heineken and Trailer Clash change to, was it Miller or Budweiser? Budweiser.
Budweiser, King of Beers.
That was literally the dialogue. There was a Heineken ad right in the middle, and then later in the film, he says he likes Heineken, and Hopper's character, the villain, says Heineken is shit, Pabst, Blue Ribbon.
Right. Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Lynch must have gotten a lot of beer money to make this movie.
Oh yeah, and really, now that we're talking about the party scene and the beer and all that, sampled by three different artists, a lot of that dialogue. Do you remember? Well, I don't know if you're familiar with all of them, but can you name them?
I didn't notice any of those. There was a scene after the whole Joyride that I think Nine Inch Nails sampled.
Oh wow, I missed that,
Some of the
but.
background noises when he woke up after the Joyride sounded like the beginning of Head Like a Hole.
But
But I didn't catch any of the dialogue, no.
let's see. First, of course, the most obvious. Hurry and let's hit the fucking road.
Oh, okay, you put it like that, yes.
Ministries, Jesus Built My Hot Rod, of course. And I was like, God damn, that I could not place Dennis Hopper's voice. And he used Dennis Hopper on the same album, NWO, It's All Right, It's All Right, from Apocalypse Now. So he's got two Dennis Hopper sound bites on the album. The other one from this movie, we have the whole warm beer, I hate warm beer thing. It was sampled by Mr. Bungle.
Okay.
It's just kind of in the background at the end of I think it was Squeeze Me Macaroni at the very end, where they're just like yelling in this whole cacophony thing, and he's got that playing. And then Anthrax, actually, this is from a different scene. Anthrax had sampled the "I can still hear your fucking radio" for "Eye of the Man."
Oh, it's been ages since I've heard I'm the Man.
I just happened to hear it today. I was like, "Oh my God, it's another Blue Velvet soundtrack."
Oh, wow.
So Ministry, Mr. Bungle, Anthrax, and you think Nine Inch Nails too, huh?
Go back and listen to the background sounds when he wakes up, in the middle of that sort of industrial area.
Okay. I think I know what you're talking about. And yeah, I'll take a look. I'll take a listen for it. And so now we come to why that all these artists have sampled from this particular part of the film, Dean fucking Stockwell.
Well, Dean fucking Stockwell, and also Hopper,
Yeah.
because this is one of Hopper's best performances, I think. I absolutely despised his character,
Yeah.
but that's just a testament to his genius in the role, because I normally like his characters.
I mean, they say this revived his career,
Oh, yeah.
that his career is pretty dead at this point.
But Dean Stockwell, yeah, I've never seen him playing that far out of type.
No. It took me a second to realize that it was him. I'm like, that looks an awful lot. Holy shit, that is. All right, so let's lay the picture on them. We will give them that. He had a very white makeup, like a pale face. He had lipstick, and he had this nice pearl earring kind of
Hanging down.
wrapped around the back
Oh, no,
of
he had a
the ear.
cuff.
It was a cuff. And he does this lip syncing performance. It was Roy Orbison.
Of Dreams.
Yes.
Which apparently they couldn't get the rights for, but they found some other legal way around to use it. Like, Roy Orbison would not give them the rights to use the song because he despised the movie. But they found some other kind of legal workaround.
How do you suppose that that is, though? I
Hey,
mean,
that's all I know. I couldn't find exactly how they did it, but they found some other way around it.
they
Let's use it legally.
they played his performance of it. And really, there's only three songs in the whole fucking movie, if you think about it.
Unlike Blue Velvet, because they couldn't get the rights to Bobby Vinton's version, but for the first time you hear it in the movie, that classic version,
Yeah.
they recorded a sound alike.
Oh, wow.
They used the exact same orchestration. They found someone who could do a dead-on impression, and that was recorded for the movie. That was not Bobby Vinton's version. And then, of course, there's Isabella Rossellini's version. See my sponsor.
Yeah.
Oh, and about that scene, just one little more little thing. Okay, she starts off singing. She's got a piano player, a guitarist, a bassist, drummer, and a sax player. By
Are
the
they
end of
all?
the song, everybody but the piano player has disappeared.
Yeah, David Lynch doesn't like to play by the rules.
I just thought it was, again, really obvious that these four musicians just disappeared in the middle of a song. And she's still singing Blue Velvet. It's not like it's later in the set.
Well, right. That's all she sings.
Same song. Somehow, they didn't just stop playing, they left the stage. The drum kit left the stage.
She does just sing that one song again and again.
Thankfully, she doesn't try to sing anything else.
Yeah, I don't know what else. I mean, I think there was a reason for that. I mean, this was, she was no mostly just known as a model.
And a spokesperson, yeah.
Yeah, at this point. And this was McLaughlin's only his second role.
Dune was his first, and then this.
Yes.
He starts with two David Lynch movies, and he still manages to have a career.
Well,
Well,
I
actually,
think
let's look at his career.
that's why he has a career, because
Yeah,
he
Lynch.
does take chances.
Well, and he's worked with Lynch multiple times. This Dune, Twin Peaks.
You don't have to worry about keeping the perfect reputation,
Yeah,
I
yeah.
mean, he's just He can do what he wants.
Actually, the only thing I can think of that wasn't Lucha Showgirls.
Yeah. I could see us doing a couple of his other movies when I looked at his
Yeah,
IMDb.
yeah. Eraserhead's kind of a classic, even though I'm not real eager to see it.
I was thinking McLaughlin.
Oh, oh,
But for Lynch, yeah, we probably will wind up doing Eraserhead one of these days.
What are you thinking with McLaughlin?
Well, McLaughlin, there was the movie, the third movie he did after this. I think I remember seeing that from back in the day, The Hidden.
Okay. Not familiar with it.
And then the other one, if we ever want to do a Shakespearean trilogy, it's Ethan Hawke's Hamlet.
Okay. We could do plenty of Shakespeare if we want to go
Where he
there.
played, where he played Claudius.
Now, just getting back to the movie. Again, like I said, Hopper's best performance that I've seen. His character was incredibly disturbing. And I basically wanted him dead after his first scene.
I don't know, I'm still a sucker for Apocalypse Now, but that wasn't really acting. I mean, that was a man really coked out of his mind when he was doing Apocalypse Now.
Now, several of the actors who were considered for the role of Frank found the character too repulsive and intense. Hopper, by contrast, is reported to have exclaimed, "I've got to play Frank because I am Frank."
I almost feel he reprises this role in True Romance in a way. I mean, it's a bit more subtle in True Romance. It's a bit more pull reined in.
Don't think you could get less subtle than this movie.
Yeah, right. That's right. This movie is all just about letting it out, quite literally.
Incidentally, after the commercial and critical failure of Lynch's Dune in '84, he made attempts at developing a more personal story, somewhat characteristic of the surreal style he developed with his debut, Eraserhead. A more personal story.
Well, I guess it's about growing up in that small town.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. The film story originated from three ideas that crystallized the filmmaker's mind over a period of time, starting as early as 1973. The first was only a feeling in the title Blue Velvet, Lynch told Cineast in 1987. The second idea was an image of a severed human ear lying in a field. I don't know why it had to be an ear, except that it needed to be an opening of a part of the bo an opening of the part of the body, a hole into something else. The ear sits on the head that goes right into the mind, so it felt perfect. Lynch remarked in an interview, quote, "The third idea was Bobby Vinton's classic rendition of the song Blue Velvet and the mood that came with that song, a mood, a time, and things that were of that time. So maybe it was set in the 50s."
Oh yeah, it definitely was. The way that the kids were dressed.
Yeah. There were a few anachronisms that just
Oh
took that away,
yeah.
took
Oh
me out
yeah,
of that.
that whole party scene when they with the kids, when they go to the kids' party, it really lost the whole 50s feel. I mean, even though they were dressed for it, they were in a wood paneled room with heavily synthesized music. It completely went into like a 70s 80s feel, which just was very out of place.
Also, speaking of the personal story, the scene in which Dorothy appears naked outside was inspired by a real-life experience Lynch had during childhood when he and his older brother saw a naked woman walking down a neighborhood street at night. The experience was so traumatic to the young Lynch that it made him cry, and he's never forgotten it.
Now, I normally don't go and read other criticisms before we do the show because, I like to give as much of my own criticism as possible. But I needed help with this.
Yeah.
I knew there was so much more going on to this that than there was, and I had to figure out what the fuck was going on here. There's many different theories on this. One of them being that this is an Oedipal complex.
Frank, Hopper's character definitely had mother issues.
Right, that they all were a family, and Frank being the father, Dorothy being the mother, and the father and the son being at odds with each other to get the mother for himself. And then of course there's the whole bug thing. So, I don't know.
by the way. Although initially detested by some mainstream critics, the film is now widely acclaimed and earned Lynch his second Academy Award nomination for Best Director. Still not sure which side of that bit of revisionism I'm on.
Yeah, I can't see detesting this, but I also can't see this being like an Oscar-worthy directing
No,
performance.
no.
I mean, like I said, when you have so many inconsistencies and just you can say they were intentional, but they didn't come off it that way. They just came off as lazy filmmaking.
Yeah, that's the problem.
And I mean, we just saw Deathstalker last week, which is the Citizen Kane
Of
of
lazy
lazy
filmmaking,
filmmaking.
yeah. And a lot of it was similar. That's why I'm not sure if the bad acting and writing was a trying to make a point about the small town, or it was just bad writing and bad acting.
I could see the acting being, switching from presentational to realistic, being intentional, though.
Yeah. And dialogue that just is a bit too stilted and formal fits the small town.
But yeah, there's just something I'm missing here.
And I gotta admit, the film did grow on me as it went along, because I really kind of hated it up until the joyride scene. Not that I enjoyed it after that, but it pulled me in.
I was kind of on the fence, but I do think that the as I termed it, the hootenanny scene is sort of worth the price of admission on its own.
Yeah. I think it might be another case like Black Rainbow, where I didn't like it, but I have to respect it.
Yeah, I agree, definitely.
Oh, just gotta nitpick one little thing. The whole thing starts because Jeffrey, McLaughlin's character's father, has a stroke at the very beginning of the film, which was a great curveball. You don't see it coming.
Right.
Except strokes usually paralyze one side of the body, usually the left. This didn't really look to paralyze anything. He was using both arms.
True. Yeah, I'm not even sure what that was in the beginning, honestly.
According to the Wikipedia, it was a stroke. They didn't say that in the movie, I don't think.
Yeah.
But it looked kind of like that. So yeah, they were a little inaccurate. You don't go to a Lynch movie for accuracy. Now, I gotta say, the ending was satisfying, but not as satisfying as it could have been.
I think that's where my problem is with this more than anything else. The ending. What are we, I mean, all right, so I got only after reading I got the love over the darkness and all that stuff. But what have these people grown to from all this,
Absolutely nothing.
Exactly. What they've stared the devil in the face, and now they're back in their 1950s town, in their perfect 1950s town with the Norman Rockwell family, and they're just kind of like, "Whoa, it's a crazy world out there." Ha ha ha.
Yeah,
I'm
in
like,
fact,
"Wait,
that line comes back again. He says it
what?"
early in the movie, and then she says it again at the end.
So, yeah. It left me flat,
Actually, I was talking about Frank's death. I would have liked to have seen it more slow and painful. He gets shot through the head. I'd rather would have seen him, having his reproductive organs eaten off by a dog while being very slowly drawn and quartered. But you're also right about the final scene.
I don't think I would have wanted to have seen that. No, it was all about outsmarting him.
I just despised the character and wanted to see him suffer. Getting shot in the head, not quite enough suffering for my tastes.
But it wouldn't have been believable. I mean,
No,
he
no,
had to
no.
have
Yeah.
the element of
Oh,
surprise. That
absolutely.
was the only way he was going to beat Frank,
Right.
was if he had the jump on him. And even the jump he had on him was kind of iffy. Why
Yeah.
didn't Frank realize where he was? And I guess maybe he didn't realize that he would have taken a gun with him.
Yeah.
He still didn't give the kid enough credit,
No.
like. He thought he was dumb enough to stay on the radio where he was. He thought he was dumb enough to just be sitting there waiting for Frank to come for him.
Which kind of gives credence to your Oedipus analysis. Yeah, the father underestimating the son.
Yeah, and I can't take credit for the Oedipus analysis. In over my head, this one. I don't know why.
But I still can't get past the acting. It was either completely flat or way over the top.
I did like the performances in the end. Like, when you step back and look at the film as a whole, I think I really do like the performances that were delivered here. I think they were all delivered purposefully. And I guess that's why Lynch gets the credit that he does for being a good director, because he at least gets the best out of his actors and actresses.
Incidentally, he had complete artistic freedom and final cut privileges on the film.
This is probably a payback for Dune.
With the stipulation that the filmmaker had to take a salary cut and work with a $6 million budget, and his rough cut was 4 hours long.
Holy shit.
Don't have it in my notes, but one of the actors they were approaching to play Jeffrey said he wouldn't do it because he considered it pornography. When he saw the final cut, he said he would have done it.
Ah.
So something is in that remaining 2 hours that is far worse than anything we see in the film.
Well, my only guess is that when they take the joyride, that there is more to it than that.
Yeah, probably.
Because when it fades to black, he put lipstick on him, and then he was wiping the lipstick off, and I think it went to black after that. Who knows what exists there? Almost surprised there hasn't been a director's cut of this in the age of director's cut DVDs.
Oh, and speaking of Lynch's structure, this is kind of impressive. Jeffrey says, "I'm in the middle of a mystery, exactly halfway through the film." That had to be on Lynch, and it's very impressive if it was intentional.
It couldn't have been on purpose because he cut, unless that was originally 2 hours into the film, which
Good point.
I couldn't see it being 2 hours into the film
Had
because
to be
there.
luck then, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm done with my notes.
As am I.
No sequels, remakes. Who could pull off a remake?
Wow, Lynch could just do it again.
Lynch could do it again. I mentioned Black Rainbow. I think Panos Cosmatos could do it.
True.
He did pull off Insanely Creepy with Black Rainbow.
I mean, why not just let Lynch do this again with a better budget?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if he could get the cast quite like this, though.
It is kind of his best known movie.
I was going to say a better singer, but I think the point was she sucked.
That is a distinct possibility, yeah.
Because at first I was like, she's not good. Oh, yeah, I guess. I mean, she's just singing in a dive bar.
Right, yeah. Didn't think about that. All right, on to brains.
On the brains.
Now, once again, I did not have anything in my notes. I was waiting to discuss it to make up my mind. I didn't enjoy the movie, like I've said. Admittedly, I don't think I understood a lot of it, but I do think it should be seen. I'm going for.
Oh wow. I've been struggling with this. I've been back and forth between 3 and 4 for several days now, actually. The performances, like I said, are all, I think they're all wonderful performances. I mean, some better than others. For Hopper alone, for Dean Stockwell's scene alone, and of course, if you're a fan of any of the three bands I mentioned, you should see it. So I'm going to go with 4 as well.
All right, and what have we learned?
We learned that Dean Stockwell needs some color.
And I learned that I've really underestimated him as an actor. I really didn't think he could do anything other than Al.
I think the real reason why I'm recommending it is because there is so much more to it. You know? Like, I had to read up on it just because I knew I was missing a whole lot. And it doesn't often happen with the movies where I'm like, wait, I can't figure out what the fuck he's trying to say here.
Especially when early on we said it was a sledgehammer. And yet neither of us was really sure what he's saying.
Yeah, because there's only like a little point speck on the end of that sledgehammer that he's trying to deliver to us, and yet he's delivering to us the entire sledgehammer.
All right, so until 2 weeks from now, when we'll be reviewing Knights of Badassdom, I have been waiting literally almost 3 years to see this movie.
I think I've been waiting just as long too. Anything with Dinklage.
Speaking of Trailer Clash, I first heard about it when I first started listening to their show. I went back on their archives and it was early August 2011 when they reviewed the trailer.
Wow.
And it just came out. I mean, it's not brand new, but it just came out a few months ago. Probably this year. So we're finally getting to it. Like I said, really been looking forward to this. Not sure what my expectations should be, but we'll find out. Until then, go to zombietakeout.com, check out the album art, the episode description, of course, the episode itself, which you're already listening to. Links to find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and YouTube. Links to subscribe via RSS and iTunes. Please leave us a rating and a review at iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. You also find the movie list, every movie we've reviewed so far, and every movie we're going to review, up through 217, I believe. The request form, if you've got a movie you'd like to hear us review, please leave it on the request form. And the recommendations list. I don't think either of us expected it to get there at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, this one is not like a confident recommendation, really, is it?
It's not really a recommendation as it's a good movie. It's a recommendation of you gotta see this shit
Yeah,
to
that is
really
true.
get your head around it. You can also email us at zombietakeout@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 414-368-ZTO1 or for the alphanumerically challenged,
The king of go fuck yourselves.
414-368-9861. Wasn't sure if you were doing that or some variation of don't fucking look at me. Of course, you will always be calling from the middle of Milwaukee. And until next time, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.
Here's to an interesting experience, huh?
I'll drink to that.
So, until next time, when we'll be reviewing Knights of Badassdom.
And we're taking next week off.
Oh, we are. Okay, I'll take that again. Forgot.